This is the You Can Learn Chinese podcast. For everyone who's trying to learn Chinese or reaching for the next level, you came to the right place. I am your host, Jared Turner, longtime resident of China, co-founder of the Mandarin Companion Graded Reader Series, and my New Year's resolution is to stop seeking the approval of strangers. As long as everyone's okay with that. My co-host is John Passon, co-founder of Mandarin Companion, founder of All Set Learning, the Chinese Grammar Wiki, Sinospice.com, and informed me that due to travel restrictions, this year, the United States had to organize the coup at home. In this episode, John and I talk about the difference between how you think your Chinese sounds versus how it really sounds. Surprise, surprise, there is a difference. Interview is with Linda Yi, creator of Panda Cub Stories and a heritage speaker who spent years trying to fit in before fully embracing her cultural identity. All this and more, let's get to it. Hey guys, this is Jared Turner coming at you from Utah in the United States.
And coming out of Shanghai, China, I am John Pasden. Hey guys.
The crowds go wild. All right, John, it's a new year. You ready for this?
I am ready. We've got lots of good stuff.
Okay, we got two reviews. This is from Adiel Fernandez Grana. Hello, Jared and John. First of all, thanks a lot for the podcast and books. I use them all the time. During the Christmas holidays, I was reading again three of your books, and I think this is the third time I've read every one of them. Sometimes I feel frustrated because I'm not progressing as quick as I think I could. So now, instead of keep trying to learn new things, I try to become more fluent on what I already know. Because of it, I am reading your books. I'm living in Xiamen, so if you come to visit, I'll be happy to share a coffee or beer with you. Big thanks, Addy. P.S. I'm looking forward to reading the new books. Well, hey, well, thanks, Addy. We appreciate that. And I'm glad to hear that, you know, rereading, that's a pretty good tip, isn't it?
Yeah, for sure. You can get a lot out of a second, third, even more reads. And I actually really like Xiamen. Might take you up on that beer. Okay, we have another review. This one is from your dad's mom via Apple Podcasts in Canada. 5-star, read the books. This podcast preaches the power tool of comprehensible input, which if anyone else has done boring Chinese classes, probably never tried aside from Wang Peng Hao Shuaya. This is the missing piece to turn boring, abstract concepts like grammar to something you can feel out, just like how you can feel out your native language. Thanks to comprehensible input, in only 4 months, I went from taking a month to read Emma, which is level one, to reading both Great Expectations in 2 days.
Ooh.
So that's our two-part level two. Thank you, John and Jared. Here's hoping for those level three books soon because intermediate Chinese content is pretty limited. P.S. to my fellow learners, please avoid translating it in your head too much. My friends, strangely enough, learn to only read quickly, mapping characters to English pronunciation. That's a good tip. Trying to translate too much in your head, especially when you don't really need to, is not going to help you.
Yeah, but it's a hard habit to break too.
Yeah, and rather than like trying really hard and reading slowly and like, you know, straining to not translate, it's better just read more. Like the more you read, the more you push yourself to try to read faster, then the more naturally you'll be able to avoid translating in your head.
Totally. Well, thanks your dad's mom. It's like an insult or something. I don't know. He's from Canada. We'll give him that.
All right, guys. So today we have a topic related to tones, which is something you cannot escape when you're learning Mandarin Chinese. We like to talk about reading and fluency and comprehensible input, but every now and then we come back to this topic, which is so primary to speaking Chinese, which is tones. So, Jared, you never had any problems with tones, right?
Ni hao. No, not at all.
Right. Jared's a typical learner. We've all been there. But today we want to talk about tones and perception. So the idea is how you think your tones sound and how native speakers think your tones sound don't always match up. You know, surprise, surprise.
And spoiler, there's usually a difference.
Yeah, and if you're looking for a way to become more humble, this is a good way to do that as well.
Yeah, so listen for this for a piece of humble pie. John, what are you serving up today?
Well, we've gotten some feedback from our listeners, and some people have said that they really like it when we dig into like academic papers and stuff. And we're not doing a deep dive into a paper today, but this one actually started with a paper by Liao Rongrong. I wrote about it on Sinosplice years ago after attending ACTFL.
The American Council of Foreign Language Teachers.
It's when there's no COVID, they have a yearly conference. Dr. Liao had this talk on an alternative way to teach Mandarin tones in speaking. So I want to start out by kind of summarizing what Dr. Liao said, and then we'll launch into our own discussion. So three main points here. One, Chinese teachers are giving students of Chinese the wrong picture of tones, especially with regards to third tone.
Mm-hmm.
Two, tones are not of equal importance in natural speech. So what she means by that is some of them are emphasized and some are de-emphasized. And three, funny-sounding foreigner speech can be corrected most efficiently by focusing on certain key tones in a sentence. Okay, let's back up here, and we're going to look at these points and bring in some like kind of side points, bring in some of our own stories. Hopefully this will all be helpful. First of all, we're giving students of Chinese the wrong picture of tones, and third tone in particular.
Oh, yeah.
So if you study third tone, you know that it's the falling and rising tone, the dipping tone. And so a lot of times people are really focused on, you know, like this crazy dip. Exactly. And sometimes they don't even go that low. It's more like, so I didn't go as low that time, but I dipped, right? Okay, so here's the important thing. Third tone, in order to be understood, needs to be really low. And that's more important than the dipping. And we're not going to go into all the crazy tone changes, but just know this. Third tone has to be low.
You know, John, this is a really good thing that we talked about in an interview I had recently with Ola Linga with Hacking Chinese. It's in episode 48, and he talks about this extensively where he's saying, hey, you know, it's a low tone. It's not so much like that scooping tone. It's as important to think about as a low tone.
Yeah, actually, I want to read a comment from Ola on my original blog post about this topic. He wrote, I found this article and the underlying research so interesting that I decided to write my bachelor thesis in Chinese about teaching the third tone. My conclusion is similar to Dr. Liao's, i.e. that there is call for a different approach to the third tone, regarding it as an essentially low tone instead of a falling, rising tone.
Oh, snap.
Bam.
John, you know what that makes you? That makes you a thought leader. Hoo-hoo-hoo.
Oh, well, I think I have to give the credit to Dr. Liao, but anyway, it is an important concept. It's also something that you can find on the Chinese pronunciation wiki. It's not something you normally see in the tone diagram, but third tone has to be low. I want to bring in two little side points that I think will help a lot of learners, especially intermediate learners that are trying to perfect their tones because they know they still get them wrong. Okay, so we just said third tone needs to be low, right?
Right.
Now, this affects both second and third tone. Because if you pronounce a second tone, but you're starting too low, then it can sound kind of like a third tone to native speakers. I don't think we need to give lots of examples, but just second tone shouldn't be starting super low, right?
Yeah.
And in the same way, third tone, if you don't go low enough and you have the falling and rising, then what native speakers hear is the rising and the fact that it's not that low. So it sounds like a second tone.
You know, John, I had this problem once when I was trying to practice with a friend. She was like, oh yeah, your second tone and your third tones don't sound right. She was kept trying to help me say the third tone. And I was like, ma, ma. And she was like, no, no, it's not right. It's ma, you know, or ma. And I recognize now, looking back, I was frustrated with the situation because I couldn't seem to get it right. But looking back, I recognize now the problem was is exactly what you're saying. My third tone was not low enough. I was, instead of like going low and, you know, and coming up a little bit, I was like going middle and coming up.
You were probably focusing on the falling, rising contour rather than on the lowness.
Exactly. Kept coming across as the second tone. And I was trying this for like 10, 15 minutes with her. And she kept like, no, no, it's like you're doing the second tone, second tone.
So frustrating. And here's an important point. This is super interesting. You can research this in linguistics. It's one of perception. You could take out some software and you could like graph the tone, the pitch contour that you're making. You can show them like, look at the tone contour. You can see it falling and rising. Clearly, I'm making a third tone.
Well, John, you have some software. I know you had some software that can measure that, right?
Yeah, yeah, I did that for my thesis. But the point is, even if you can do that, that doesn't matter if that's not what they're hearing.
Yeah.
Right? It's an issue of perception.
Exactly. I'm falling and rising. Doesn't matter. If they still hear it as a second tone, it's a second tone to them. Perception is reality, unfortunately.
So you need to figure out how to manipulate perception of native speakers. And when it comes to third tone, the way to do that is to just go low. I think we can do just a quick little demonstration here. What does a third tone sound like, Jared?
Ma.
Okay, so see, that was kind of low, but you can definitely go lower. If you want it to sound really clear to a native speaker, then you can be like, ma, like super low.
Ma.
You know you're going as low as you can when your voice starts to crack. It's like, ma, like that creaking noise.
You know, that's actually true. I remember when the first time someone was trying to teach me how to say, you know, me, wo, they were like, whoa. It was pretty low.
But that's clear to a native speaker.
Mm-hmm.
And this is another point I wanted to bring up where I know that I myself have felt, and many of my clients have felt, like they're being kind of clownish, almost like they're mocking the language if they pronounce it too exaggeratedly. But actually, by exaggerating, you're being clearer.
Yeah.
So the perception is totally different for native speakers.
One thing I always like, if you hear like any ads in Chinese, they always have that, like that big announcer's voice, you know, 我要去买东西. Really exaggerated, but that actually is good.
Right. It makes things clearer.
I'll give you one other note on this is I remember early on as well, one of my buddies, Vaughn, when he was trying to help me to get my tones right. One of the problems I had was with the fourth tone. It's, you know, that falling tone. And I was saying like, 我要去. And right now I'm not even saying it that great, but I was like, 我要去. But he's like, no, take it like a jump, you know, like a diving board, like 我要去. And that's better. It's more pronounced.
Yeah. And some people say that the fourth tone sounds kind of angry. They don't want their Chinese friend to think they're angry. I think some people, let me tell you, I don't think any Chinese person has ever thought that a foreigner was angry because the foreigner was clearly pronouncing fourth tone. It just doesn't happen.
Amen.
That whole thing about like being super clear with every tone. All right, that brings us to the second point, which is tones are not of equal importance in natural speech.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't have to do that for every single tone. But if you're making a sentence and there's a key word, like maybe you're telling people your name, or maybe it's what you want to buy or whatever, there's going to be a key word there. And so for that key word, if you slow down a little bit and exaggerate the tones, it's going to make the whole sentence clearer to the native speaker.
So John, what would be a good example of this?
Okay, so like buying something. So if you're like, 我要买, I'm kind of emphasizing the 买. But if I'm emphasizing what I'm buying, like I want to buy bread, 我要买面包. So 我要买 is pretty quick. The tones are not that emphasized, but 面包, like I slow down, I emphasize the fourth and the first. And that's going to make it a lot clearer to the person who's listening to my Chinese.
Well said. Well said. It's something that it's going to be hard to teach, you know, what are those words to emphasize in every sentence? And there's infinite amounts of combinations of sentences. But this is something that as you start to pay attention to it, you may begin to notice it in the speech of native speakers, or if you're listening to tapes or shows or songs or whatever, and it's something you start to get the feel for. But just being conscious of this dynamic can really help you to start get a better feel for the language.
Right. And I want to emphasize one other thing too. Like I just said that you don't have to emphasize every tone of every character. It's better to emphasize certain keywords. But there's also the opposite approach, which is also wrong, which is emphasizing nothing.
Mm-hmm.
Like, if I speak really fast, then I don't have to use tones because that's what native speakers do. And everyone will just think I sound like them and they'll understand me even though I don't know any of the tones. No, guys. No, that doesn't work.
I have recently had a comment on one of my memes. And this one commenter said, bold of you to think I use tones. She's joking. But the truth is that there are some people just like, you know, I'll just slough it off. That's not really important. People understand me, right?
Well, it's one of those cases of like trying to run before you can walk. Native speakers can run, but you can't. So you kind of got to walk. And the other thing is that if you've heard a lot of Chinese, like especially if you live in China, you kind of start unconsciously acquiring the correct tones for the super common words and phrases. You think you're not using tones, but you're actually kind of getting them right because you've heard them so many times. But then when you get to that one word, which is the key word, which you're not quite as used to saying, it really pays off to slow down, exaggerate the tones a little bit, and then people are going to understand you like best possible. Obviously, you need to know the tones. If you don't know the tones, then you're in kind of sketchy territory, but you emphasize the keywords.
You know, I got to say one of the worst is that, you know, you look up a character after you've been, you thought the tone was a certain way. You look up like 6 months later and you realize you've been using it wrong. So that's also normal life, right? I've made mistakes like that. Perhaps you still make mistakes like that, John. I don't know. But you're going to make some mistakes. But you got to roll with it. And you can always check back on things if you need to.
I think everyone's going to make those mistakes. They're just a lot more egregious in the beginning. And in the end, they get to be like more and more obscure words. And it's less embarrassing. But getting back to Dr. Liao's points, her final point was funny sounding speech can be corrected most efficiently by focusing on certain key tones.
So go through this, John. I'm really interested to hear about what are the great ways to help correct these.
Well, for the most part, if you know like your basic sentence patterns, you know the tones and you've practiced those, then those aren't going to be too bad. So really, it means you're focusing on the new words. So if you're going out to buy something, you want to buy bread, make sure you look up the tones ahead of time. You know what the tones are. Practice it a bit. So then by focusing on getting that right as the key word in the sentence, that sentence is going to come out way better.
No, that makes a lot of sense. So it's a little bit like prepare. Prepare ahead of time and practice a little bit when you're going into a situation where you know some of the things you're going to need to say.
That's right. I do want to give one other tip for learners. I don't have any research on this, but it's something that I have definitely felt over the years. I think it's useful to a lot of people. And it relates to a point I was making earlier about second and third tone. And the point is that for us foreigners, second and third tone can be easy to confuse. The same is true for first and fourth tone. So first and fourth tone can both sound really forceful or, I don't know, loud. And second and third have that rising thing going on. So be careful about confusing second and third and first and fourth.
Okay, John, I will be careful.
I don't think you will, Gerald.
Gerald.
I don't think you will, Jared.
I think I will now. Hi, my name is Gerald Turner. I'm the new co-host. Something that comes back to mind is one of the interviews that we highlighted as one of the top interviews of 2020. It was in our last podcast, and it came from Chris Max, episode 28. He got into studying Chinese. He was learning. He made some great progress early on, and he worked really hard at it. But then they were saying like, oh, look, you're doing great, but your tones are off, but it's too late. They're never going to be great, you know? And he's like, what? No, that's not how I want it to be. You know, I want my tones to be right. I want to sound, you know, like a native speaker. And so he said he took, 2 months off from just studying anything new. And he only focused on tones for that 2 months. It sounded way better. And people just started treating him differently. And perhaps I can relate a little bit, you know, if you run across someone who's a native speaker of your language and, you know, maybe you've been abroad. I know this one guy who used to say speaks American. It's just a little bit different a connection because it's not just they know the language, they know the euphemisms, they know the feel of the language. It's a bit easier to make a deeper connection.
Totally. But one thing I want to emphasize is that you don't have to spend 2 months exclusively on tones. Tones are very important, yes. But actually, if you make them important from the very beginning and don't minimize them, don't try to tell yourself they're not important and keep working on them as a long-term thing, you're going to be way better off. And the other point is that third tone is a low tone, low. So make that tone low.
Oh, yeah. But I think something else to circle back to where we started here is, John, you said that the way we think our Chinese sounds versus the way it sounds to natives, it's different. And that's really important to remember. And sometimes that can get away from you in Chinese because Chinese natives are so apt to tell you how good your Chinese is. I really appreciate it. But also it can have that double edge is where you start to think that your Chinese is better than it really is. It can even stop our overall Chinese learning because we may think, oh, it's just good enough, right? People can understand me. But there's always more to learn and you never have to stop learning.
Yeah, learning Chinese is definitely a lesson in humility if you're serious about it and you take it far. It's okay. It's okay. You'll get there.
You will. All right, now it's time for a word from our sponsor. And our sponsor is
Mandarin Companion.
Imagine that.
And we have a new level 2 book coming out.
Jekyll and Hyde. Not Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. This is Jekyll and Hyde.
Well, we're not the only ones to ever do that with the title, but yeah, it's our version of this classic tale.
How much can we tell about the plot without ruining anything?
Nothing. We can tell nothing.
Well, there's this guy named Jekyll and this guy named Hyde, and there's this medicine he's developing, and he likes this girl, but she likes someone else, and well, that's about as much as you're going to know, but it gets pretty intense pretty fast, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's kind of a wild ride. And I should mention that if you're trying to progress from level 1 to level 2, this level 2 is slightly more accessible than either Great Expectations or Journey to the Center of the Earth. So it has that going for it as well.
And the cover image is super cool. It's nice.
Yeah, I'm having a lot of fun with the illustrations. Back in the day, I wanted to be a comic book artist or something, but I never really pursued it seriously. So for this book, I get to sketch out the drawings in my amateur way and then give them to the illustrator, and he does really good work.
Yes, go out there, and actually, you can't get it yet, but it goes live on the Friday after this podcast goes live, which is going to be January 15th. So it's Jekyll and Hyde. It's a Mandarin Companion Level 2 graded reader based on 450 basic characters. Go out there and pre-order it today.
Yeah, and let me say, this is my favorite Level 2 book now, so I give it a big recommendation.
Hoo-ah! All right, now it's time for Rants and Raves. John, what do you got for us today? You got a rant or do you have a rave?
All right, so I have a rave today. It's a really cool website. I saw it recommended by Kaiser Guo, who was also on our show in the past. This website is called Chinese Film Classics. These are some really old movies. They're hosted on the University of British Columbia's website. Let me just read a little credit here. Most of the films were translated by Christopher Ria and the subtitles created by Liu Yuqing or Yao Jiaqi. New Women was translated by Eileen Chung-In Chow and the subtitles were created by Andrew Rodecor. All right, so anyway, you can download these classic movies. You can download subtitles and translations. I haven't had a lot of time to look into it yet myself, but what I've seen so far looks awesome. And because these movies are old, like there's no like sensitive copyright issues. I know I talk to people all the time. You know, they want to watch more Chinese movies, but they have trouble getting many Chinese movies besides like Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon or whatever. And if you don't mind the movies being a little bit older, then there are a lot of cool movies here. Let me see. How many are there? Looks like 20-something movies. Definitely check these out. Let us know what you think. And remember, a movie might not be the best way to improve your Chinese, especially if you're just a beginner, but it's also a good way to enjoy Chinese and to be exposed a little bit. I remember back in the day when I was just starting with Chinese, I watched the movie Huozhe, meaning to live. That's the English title, To Live. And I didn't understand a lot of the dialogue, but I actually did understand like a line here or there, and I found it really gratifying to be able to just understand parts of it. We'll have links to the website in our show notes, and there's also a YouTube channel called Modern Chinese Cultural Studies. Okay, so Jared, you got a rave for us?
Actually, John, I have a rant.
Jared, the Debbie Downer.
Sorry to disappoint you. We're just coming out here in the States of the Christmas holidays coma. So I took the time to watch Mulan, the new Disney one that came out.
The live action remake.
Well, right. It wasn't a new Disney one. It was the new remake, whatever. And I just got to say, I just was not impressed. Now, there are a gazillion historical inaccuracies in this. And I mean, what do we expect, really? I felt like they could have any chance they had to like maybe violate some sort of social norm or something in Chinese or create some sort of acronym or something with Chinese history. Like it's like took that opportunity. I mean, there was just all sorts of things. I mean, from like the region, the housing and stuff that Hua Mulan came from. And I don't know, even like the dress and then the emperor, the period. It makes sense why a lot of Chinese people didn't like it. Think of it like this. Maybe like in American history, if you're trying to mix like revolutionary period with Civil War period, and then with like maybe industrialization period with some elements from England, it's like you're mixing too many things together. And aside from that, I think there were some plot things they could have really done better. I mean, it was a fun movie to watch if you didn't look for any of those things, but I would not take any cues about Chinese culture or history from this movie.
All right. Well, I didn't watch it. So.
All right. Well, John, you just keep on not watching that.
I will do that.
My name is Linda Yi. I think I'm one of the dozens of Chinese American Lindas out there because apparently it's very popular.
Linda and I met over Instagram because I totally adore the comics she creates.
So I create the Panda Cup Stories webcomic. It's basically a passion project where I document my own journey of relearning how to read Chinese as a Chinese American and exploring my family's cultural heritage.
I have a special place in my heart for all heritage learners. Although they have an advantage in learning Chinese, their challenges are again unique when compared to the average Chinese learner. Something you're going to hear in Linda's story. Stay with us. Tell us a little bit of like your background and about your experience in learning Chinese.
I was born in Chengdu, China, and my family immigrated to the States when I was 4. So that's why I consider myself ABC-ish, or I guess 1.5 gen, because I'm not quite first generation. My formative experiences and the language I'm most comfortable with is still American English. One of my earliest memories from the States is actually like quite a scary one. So I was sitting, I think, on the steps of our apartment complex, and I just remember these older kids who were probably like second graders, but they were like big kids.
They looked like
right?
giants at the time.
Right? Yeah, like kind of like looming over me, and they were talking at me in a language I couldn't understand. So obviously English. And at the time, I only remembered knowing two words in English, yes and no. I would just go like, yes, no, no, yes. Like I had no idea what I was doing. And I got so scared, I ran back into my apartment and hid. Apparently, after I moved to the States, I lost my Chinese very, very quickly. I think my mom was shocked at how quickly I went from talking Chinese all the time to like not being able to string together a sentence.
Where were you living? Where were you growing up at?
I grew up half in Ellicott City, Howard County, Maryland, and half in Augusta, Georgia.
What was that experience for you growing up where it sounds like, all right, you did retain some Chinese, obviously. Mm-hmm. I mean, there was a bit spoken at home, but like, what was that interaction like? I mean, was that something that you were just not interested in or you avoided?
So I think had a very typical Chinese American like diaspora upbringing experience from age 4 to about 12.
Describe that a little bit to us, because I have a pretty good understanding of what you probably mean by that. But there's a lot of people that don't.
There was a big Chinese American community. My parents put me in Chinese school like in first grade. And I think I was happy to go for the first year or two.
These are weekend classes.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. This is something I swear, like almost every agency, like parents are send them to this weekend Chinese class.
Yes. Yeah.
The dreaded weekend Chinese class.
You know, when you're younger, it's fine. But I think like once you start realizing that you're missing your Saturday morning cartoons and like when everyone else or all of your other friends are out doing fun weekend stuff, you're getting up at 8 a.m. to go sit for 3 hours, there would be the one kid who's like good and really excited. And I was that one kid, I think, the first year or two that I went. But then gradually you just start sitting in the back row, trade Pokemon cards and like not, you know, like listen to your Laoshi at all. Looking back, I feel bad for our Laoshi because I think most of them were volunteer parents who are like trying to teach kids who really didn't want to learn. And having taught myself, and my partner is also a teacher, there's so much work that goes into lesson planning and trying to engage students that I'm like, wow, we were just like little But I still hung out with a lot of kids and friends of mine who shared the same cultural experience. So
I mean, speaking more directly, it's probably like the Asian crowd, right? I mean,
yeah, very much
there's
so.
Probably some of those cultural divisions, right, in school.
Exactly. So I think we were super nerdy, like all of us played violin or piano or cello, and our parents would often be friends with each other. We'd go to these family parties where like our parents would be singing KTV in the basement and the kids were, you know, like doing whatever we were doing. That was very much my life until end of seventh grade. And I think that was also around the same time that I started watching my first Chinese dramas. Gosh, if Netflix existed back then, I think like I would have dropped out of school. Like I have a very addictive personality. But I was watching like Liu Xinghuayuan, Huanzhuge. While I hated going to Chinese school, I would greedily watch these shows for hours on end. So that was my life until 12. And then my mom got a job in Augusta, Georgia, which is the second largest city in Georgia after Atlanta, but much, 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 much like smaller. And when I first moved down here, there was maybe like 3 or 4 other Asian kids in my grade. And I think that kickstarted my 5 to 6 years of not having anything to do with Chinese.
Was that because it wasn't cool?
Oh, it was, yeah. It was like,
just try to fit in.
It was extremely uncool. Well, so part of it was there wasn't even an opportunity to use it. And I don't think Chinese school here had started up yet. If you've been to the South, it's also very different.
I've been to Atlanta before, right?
Oh, okay.
You know, this is some another underlying thing. You know, there's that culture shock of when you were moving to the United States and you're in Maryland. And then there's another culture shock from Maryland to Georgia.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I just remember moving down and like in eighth grade, cheerleading and middle school football was huge. And everything that was mainstream and cool was very, very Western.
Very, very American.
Very American.
Wow. I guess your Chinese went downhill a little bit during that time.
It took a nosedive.
What really was that trigger for you to say, like, I want to hold on to my culture. I want to hold on to that language of my parents.
So the summer after I graduated high school, there was a really big earthquake in Sichuan, which is where my family lives, in mid-May back in 2008.
You know, so, I was in China when that happened.
Oh, crazy.
That's my first trip to China. I was on a study abroad. It was in
Beijing. Oh, my goodness. No pun intended. It was like an earth-shattering event. Yeah, and it was awful. And so after that had happened, I remember a few friends of and I had organized this big bake, art, and like charity sale. And I was communicating with a few nonprofits that were raising like money to help. And I think that combined with the trip that had already been planned for China got me into this mindset of wanting to know more, wanting to learn more. And that summer, I can't remember if I requested it or if one of my relatives was like, well, since you're here, why don't you study with a Chinese tutor? I was curious about it. I think by then I had also embraced the nerdiness and I like learning.
Owned it, right?
Yeah. It was like, if I set my mind to something, I can do it. So I was like, all right, like bring it on. I'm going to become fluent in Chinese in a summer. That did not happen. But yeah, but like what did happen was the teacher that I studied with started me out with like xiangxingzi, so like pictograms, like simple ideograms, xingshenzi, like phonosemantic characters, which I feel like the English makes it sound very complicated, but it was the first time that someone explained Chinese characters to me in a way that broke down the logic behind it.
I'm assuming they're breaking down the different components.
Exactly.
Say radicals, right?
Yeah.
And just saying, oh, these things mean this, you know, san dian shui means water, you know, things like that, right?
Exactly. Yeah. And so I think instead of just making me memorize the components and copying them down over and over and over again, which was my experience in Chinese school, I guess she was a storyteller. So she was like, this is, you know, how our ancestors developed this language. She was also the first person who told me about sound components as well as meaning components. And I was like, oh, like instead of making Chinese characters super confusing, because what I had a lot of trouble with when I was in Chinese school was all of these characters that looked almost exactly the same, right? Like qing qing, or like ma 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 ma.
Yeah,
I was like, they look exactly the same, except it's like a little bit different on the left. Who would design a language this way? And then turning it around and being like, well, no, that's actually a clue, right? So like you know what this character might sound like, and then you look for the meaning component to jog your memory. That actually made the process even more intriguing to me as opposed to frustrating. And so that started 4 years of undergrad of taking Chinese classes and doing internships in China. And it sort of snowballed into, yeah, I guess a career.
Well, I want to hear just a few more details just about this experience for you, like getting back immersed in the language. Now, most people listening here, they didn't have that, I guess you could say, benefit of growing up, of having spoken the language, even at a very young age, you know, being fluent, you know, whatever that really means, right? But you did have a level of Chinese. You weren't starting at zero. Right.
Exactly.
So what was that experience, do you think, like for you, and how do you think is that different than maybe a normal Chinese learner who didn't have that background?
I think for me, I've always felt I never learned Chinese properly, whatever that means. But I think in my mind, I was like, there are things that I've been saying wrong the entire time. And my family is like, ah, you know, we get the gist of it. So like, it's fine. But I will say that one of the differences and difficulties of learning as a heritage speaker is when you're starting from the beginning, obviously you have different needs, right?
And what would those be?
So for example, I probably only knew how to read and write 20 characters, basically starting from zero in terms of reading and writing, but already having at least like kitchen Chinese audio comprehension. And for me, my family speaks Sichuanese, But like Sichuanese is very close to Mandarin, and all of the media that I consumed was Mandarin.
I remember once I went to Chongqing. Mm-hmm. I'm like, hey, could you speak your normal vocal dialect?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
It sounded like Mandarin mm-hmm. with different tones.
Exactly.
That's what it sounded like to me.
If you can speak Mandarin, you sort of get the gist of what's going on. Whereas if you listen to someone speaking Shanghainese or Cantonese, it's like, what is going on? Yeah, so for some programs, they just lump all of the beginners together. So some of the basics, you know, this is how you pronounce the four different tones. They're not as helpful for heritage speakers who already have familiarity with Mandarin. But I think at the same time, it also does a disservice to the non-native speakers in the class, because kids like me are in it for the easy A. That's what happened to my boyfriend, the first Mandarin class he took as a freshman in college. He basically, at the end of the semester, did like a table flip and was like, you know, screw it, like I'm done. Like there's no way I could catch up. The teacher also told the class that they needed to know 5,000 characters to be able to read. And he was like, well,
it's not true.
Nope. He was like, well, I just spent a semester learning 150. Yeah. So is it going to take me 20 years?
I give up. Now, you went and you started studying Chinese in college then.
Mm-hmm.
What were some of those little wins for you and milestones along the way?
I did not have a good time in my first Chinese class as a freshman at Duke. And part of that has to do with, so you go through a Chinese language placement exam before you get to sign up for the class you wanted to sign up in. And the good thing about my undergrad was they actually had separate tracks for native speakers and non-native speakers. So like,
oh, that's great.
Mm-hmm. But I wanted to be in the beginner native speaker track because like I had just spent like a summer intensively studying with a tutor, but I still very much felt like I was a beginner. But long story short, I sort of maybe like cheated on the placement exam. Like I didn't cheat, but like there was like an essay section that was like, you know, write an essay. Mm-hmm. And I had actually written an essay that previous summer, heavily edited by my tutor.
Oh.
You know, what I did this summer and what I like. I had basically copied that essay many, many times. So I was like, oh, like, I remember this essay. I'm just going to like copy this down.
You can just do it, right?
Cool. Yeah. So that ended up placing me into a very high level Chinese class. We were reading short stories by Lu Xun. It's not wanted to
mercy.
Be. Yeah. So like Lu Xun, for people who don't really know, he's like modern Chinese writer.
Yeah, this is native material.
Yeah. I think I would have loved to start at like, you know, Mandarin Companion level one or maybe two. Honestly, I should have dropped that class, but little miss. I've gotten straight A's through high school. I could do anything. I was like, no, I'm going to stay in this class. I didn't do super well in the class. So I think I probably forced myself to memorize 500, 800 characters that semester.
Yeah, that's a heavy load.
I would spend hours and hours copying down all of the shenshi in like the short story that I didn't know, which was like 75% of them.
Yeah.
And like a lot of them aren't words that you would use in everyday life either. So like, nope. I'm pretty sure out of the 800 characters I learned that first semester, 80% of them I forgot immediately.
Yeah. For perspective, my kids went to local Chinese schools in Shanghai. Mm. I did some analysis and they introduced roughly 700 to 800 characters a year. Trying to memorize 500 to 800 in a semester, that's a lot.
Yeah, so I took a semester off after that. I was like, this is not fun, and I'm not going to be a Chinese major, so I should not be spending 80% of my time on this.
Well, how did you get back into it?
There was a really popular Duke Study in China program that hundreds of people went to in the summers, and I want to give it another try, and I was rejected because the director was like, well, you already took the highest level. You can't take a lower level course in the summer. That was like the first time, I think, ever in my academic career up to the point that I argued with a teacher or a superior.
Breaking molds.
Indeed, right? And so like, long story short, we worked out a compromise. The compromise was I could take a class that was offered, but I would also need to find a Chinese internship that summer to like use the language in society. Basically, I worked with a Chinese nonprofit at the time. I think it's a social enterprise now called Beijinghua Dan. So they used community theater to work with migrant women and children to help build up sort of like self-confidence skills. And for the women workshops, they also had career workshops. And that was a really transformative experience. And I ended up going back to work with them for multiple summers. And my first job out of college was actually with them as well. So I was in Beijing for a year. But also that summer was, I think, the first time I was with other Chinese language students, like a third of them heritage speakers like me, the other two thirds, you know, probably students like yourself who had studied Chinese like from the ground up, but who were actually there because they wanted to be there and not because they needed a language credit, right? Or like were forced to take it. So it was a lot of fun. That summer really solidified my Chinese language learning journey. Yeah, because I think it stopped being something that I was just learning off of a book, and it started being something that was part of my life.
That's really neat to hear that story, because this is something John and I are always talking about, having a reason, having a purpose, and using Chinese not just as some academic exercise, but actually as a tool.
Mm-hmm.
How did you then get into start doing these webcomics? And I got to say, your Panda Cub stories, they're really cute. I love your art style. But how did you get into doing this?
I would say that my dual passions all throughout college and afterwards, part of it was art and part of it was Chinese/education. And I think for the longest time, I was like, I need to choose. Do I want to be an artist? Do I want to be a teacher? And I guess for a while, I taught Mandarin Chinese at a very basic level to preschoolers and kindergartners on and off, which was my first solution of tying art and education in Chinese together. I really love stories, and I love children's stories. And so I actually started creating these video letters that I would put on YouTube. And I had this giant purple paper bow that I had made. And I would tell them bilingual stories about Shi'er Shen Xiao, the Chinese zodiac, and I would doodle some stuff to drive home narrative points. But when I decided that I wanted to try and make this my career, I actually got really burnt out, because I think it's like different sitting in a classroom where I know my kids and I know what they respond to and I can change my performance based on their response. It became really different when I was in front of a camera, because I was like, I don't know who I'm talking to. I don't know if this is helpful. And so actually, like, Panda Cub Stories, the webcomic, was a side project that I started more so for me and less for the child audience that I thought I was writing for. It's very cute because I am drawn to very cute and dorky stuff, but some of the jokes aren't really written for kids in mind, right? They're internet meme jokes. Yeah, but I think what really surprised me was how easy and fun they were to do and helpful for me. And it turned out also pretty helpful for other people.
Looking back on your life and your experience, what would you have done differently?
Clarify my goals a little bit more. I want to learn Chinese. That was true, but I think a little too large. Yeah, it's like, it's very abstract and it's hard to measure how much progress you're making. So I think making goals a bit more concrete and more measurable, but also building systems of either like study or exposure that were enjoyable and easy to keep to. One of my biggest struggles was when exterior systems were removed, right? Like, I was no longer an undergrad, thus no longer going to class. Then I wasn't studying Chinese anymore at all. And I think looking back, I was haphazardly trying to piece together environments that would force me to at least keep a finger on some sort of Chinese practice. So teaching in a preschool for 3 years, I worked as an educational administrator, but I was like coordinating a program that we had in China. So I was like sending emails in Chinese and talking to parents in Chinese. So I think if I was to give myself some advice, it would be find something small that I look forward to in terms of keeping the language in my life, and then figuring out what my immediate goals are. So if it's, I want to be able to chat with my parents on WeChat, then the hours memorizing Lu Xing like essays aren't really that helpful to reaching that goal.
Well, Linda, where can people find you if they want to see what you're doing?
So my Instagram is Panda Cup Stories, and that's my Twitter as well.
Well, Linda, thanks so much for taking the time with us.
Thank you for having me. Xie xie.
You have been listening to the You Can Learn Chinese podcast. Help us spread the word by sharing this with your friends, classmates, teachers, cousins, niece, furniture shopper, arcade junkie, amaryllis grower, sandwich eater, firework watcher, bear hugger, and that one guy named Frederick. You can subscribe on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. And please write us a review so we know how we're doing. You can find us on Facebook and at mannercompanion.com. Apologies to John Cena, we just ran out of time. You Can Learn Chinese podcast is produced by myself, Jared Turner, and our editor is James Harper with Filter Productions. I'd like to thank our guest, Linda Yi, and of course, thanks to my host, the man, the myth, the legend, John Pasty. See you next time.